Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addis, will be here for the weekly interview of James Corbett of the Corbett Report. That will begin at the second break and the third break. So you have me for the first break for Thursday, October 14th, 2015, and I should say for the first segment, not the first break. But hey, good afternoon, everyone. Again, I'm Melody Cederstrom. It's great to be here this afternoon. And let's go ahead and get to the market report right away for Thursday, October 14th, 2015. Gold today was up most of the day, but a little bit pressure here late in the aftermarket trading, down a buck at 1184. You have silver, doesn't know what it wants to do, 1623. Platinum. Up 6 at 1009, with palladium up 4 at 708. USDX today was a little bit stronger today, 0.54 at 94.47. Crude oil was up 9 at 46.73. And the paper markets today, they were gleeful today, I suppose. You have the Dow up 200 points, back up over 17,141. The NASDAQ was up 87 at 48.70. The S&P was up 29 at 2023, up over that 2000 level. 10-year yield popped back up over that 2%, 2.02%, up 0.04. A lot of pressure on the euro. 0.89 at 1.14, and the foreign markets were all up 1.5 to 2%, both the Asian and the European markets. And I don't see anything that's really driving the markets. The bank numbers weren't all that good, and I guess you can never really underestimate their ability to keep this economy going and to keep that stock market to levels that keeps the calm across the nation. So they will have to begin to appreciate that calm, because I do believe we're getting close to seeing some pretty good action coming. I'll be the first one to say this: next year is an election year, and we can still have a lot happen this year. And next year is Obama's last year, thank God. And we're so close. And it's certainly, we feel, I think everyone sees that gold and silver are trying to move up. but there's still a lot of pressure in keeping it low. News of interest today, Obama came out today and, one of his things he wanted to do as commander-in-chief was to bring the troops home, but he comes out today and announced that thousands of U.S. troops are going to remain in Afghanistan past 2016. And, of course, again, as I mentioned, that was one of his major campaign pledges that he was going to bring the troops home, calling his decision to keep a 9,800-strong U.S. force in Afghanistan through much of next year and longer is the right thing to do. He says the Afghan forces are still not as strong as they need to be. You know, isn't it just really, I mean, you would think that after all this time, but again, hey, wasn't it just a month or so ago we reported on how many millions of dollars were spent to train five Syrian rebels? it was five. They might have pushed it up to nine, I'm not sure. But you can see the same millions of dollars that are just going into people's pockets, and these wars will never be ended. And of course, the poppy fields in Afghanistan are still bringing in, these bumper crops, and they were actually on the decline before we went to war over there. They were actually, the Afghanistanis, they were burning the poppy fields and so forth. But since we've been there to protect them, they have certainly have grown to, to these enormous crops. And and it's funny because the U.S. is spending billions of dollars to stop the drugs coming from there, but yet we're there to protect. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but then again, I do know gold and silver, and to me that does make sense. And I think what we're coming up to, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, the Treasury Department today told Congress that if it needs to act, that it needs to act by November 3rd, or they will be dangerously close to being unable to pay all its bills. And just 2 weeks ago, I remember reporting on this, that he had mentioned November 5th. So we lost 2 days. Now we're November 3rd. And so that is the debt limit deadline. I don't believe the government is going to default on the debt by choice. I mean, they will agree to do something to keep the government open. Doesn't mean that the government won't close some departments for a couple of weeks. They'll close the parks and recreations and things like that for that period of time. And, most of these people are reimbursed anyway when they come back to work. So, you're not going to see any major departments close. They don't close the whole government. They will use Social Security payments, they will use Medicare payments and all the other payments that checks that come out of the government, they will use that as, these people need to be paid, and so you need to do this and you need to do that. They'll use that in front of the American people to make it look terrible that or that we really don't have a debt problem, that is the Republicans, that they just need to raise that debt limit. The GOP lawmakers, thought that they were trying to rush them into approving an increase. Really? And they got, 2 weeks, and they're trying to rush them into the increase? It sounds like they're, running out of time a little bit. But it's going to be interesting since you've seen all the Republicans up there. I mean, they don't seem to have a lot. They don't seem to be very organized in Washington. And so if the government runs out and it won't be able to meet its obligations, of course, as I mentioned before, they'll talk about the, interest payments. Those are to other governments. But you have Medicare, not all of them, but, they won't be able to meet the obligations on interest payments, Medicare payments, or Social Security checks. Now, can you imagine when you have someone like Bernie Sanders that can bring in 50,000 to a meeting? Can you imagine what will happen if all those people don't get their checks? That would prove to be very interesting. if a check or two is missed and you have all these people that receive checks from the government, if one is missed, that's what it needs. That's what the government needs. But so I think the next couple of weeks will prove to be very interesting. There was another article I saw today. We know the conditioning of the American people has been going on for a long time. People have been brainwashed by the media. There are known documented government programs in existence. So this news article is not so much surprising. We heard how Obamacare was presented in such a way that, you know, for the stupid Americans would buy into the lies of Obamacare, thinking this is a good deal for them, and, you know, they'll line up and sign up for it and you know, and embrace the deal, which they did. But this article is just another example and also confirmation. Maybe those who have a hard time believing that people are brainwashed or conditioned, you know, over a period of time to accept what is happening to them. And this is just another, again, example and confirmation of just what kind of war that is being perpetrated onto the American people. And it is Obama's effort to nudge America. The government tried using behavior science to shape people's behavior. And I think what's interesting about this, and I wasn't aware of this program that the Obama administration for the past year has been experimenting in. And the experiment, the question was, is it possible to make policy more effective by using psychology on citizens? And they have a nickname for it. It's called nudging. And the idea that policymakers can change people's behavior just by presenting choices or information differently. Think about that. Not just choices, but providing information differently. You know, when you have a government that is working with the news media and how information, how the news is presented, kind of makes you wonder why, well, maybe some of these problems that are happening for various agendas across this country. This classic example is requiring people, and they use this example as an organ donor, requiring people to opt out of being an organ donor instead of opting in when they sign up for their driver's license. And without changing any rules, just this little tweak boosted the number of registered organ donors in many states. So this nudging has gained a lot of high-profile advocates, and this has been in effect for a year. You have a professor of public choice at Utah State University, Bill Shugart, but Obama was intrigued enough that he actually hired Sustine, a law professor at Harvard who co-wrote the best-known book about the topic, Nudge. He hired these guys. Obama, the President of the United States, hired these guys. And they officially adopted the idea last year when they launched into the White House's Social and Behavioral Science Team, SBST, a cross-agency effort to bring behavioral science research into the policy-making process. Now, the team has published its first annual report on this experiment. And so, I mean, it's not a big deal yet, but you have some young people clearly respond to the text. They can, you know, send text messages to selected students, and they found that the enrollment among poor students increased about 9% more, where a lot of these poor students are, you know, not to say poor students don't have initiative, but, you know, if it took some sort of a special text to get them to enroll in college, well, you know, maybe they shouldn't be there in the first place. But it showed a result of 9% more students enrolling. On certain transactions, federal vendors are required to pay a fee on quarterly sales, which they self-report through an online form. To improve honest reporting, the General Services Administration, the agency that manages the function, added a small prompt at the top of the form. And they were asking the vendors to, hey, would you please promise to tell us the truth, promised that you are submitting accurate information. Based on that, it led to a $1.5 million increase in fees in one quarter, suggesting that, they were fully reporting their sales. One area, doctors didn't seem to be as nudgeable. So they seem to ignore so much. But what's interesting is this nudge team tried this on doctors, sending letters to physicians who prescribed far more medications than their peers, informing them of their abnormally high prescription rates. But the letters had no effect on prescriptions that they were issuing. So I just found that interesting, and I didn't know that there was an official program that Obama went into effect, the SBST, from a year ago, and these are the first results. There's many more, but I just wanted to share a few of those. So, but it's interesting when we have all this violence going on in this country and the way the media reports certain things and the certain things that come out of the mouths of these politicians, just like does Black Lives Matter or does All Lives Matter? I mean, these are all seeds that are being planted into these minds, these unstable minds that are out there. And I do believe it is a way to make people do things that perhaps they wouldn't normally do. And, people probably, you're crazy. Well, I don't think so. But and it's hard. This is hard for some people to even believe that this would be true. And I'm not saying it's true for all the bad things that happen out there, but it does make you wonder how much impact does this truly have. They are trying to do things, and it's out in the open now. A lot of the other reports and all the other tests and programs were all sort of secret and private and so forth. No longer. Another thing I wanted to bring to your attention today, you're going to hear a little bit more about it. One of my competitors I mentioned before, a big shortwave gold and silver company. We used to affectionately call them the Muffler Man. Located in Minnesota. And Minnesota did come out with some very strict laws for gold dealers in that state. And that's been in effect for a year or so. A lot of things are going to be blamed on this law. The law is going to be blamed that they're going out of business because of this law, that this law is making them do this and this law is making them do that. And it's this law that is, and I don't agree with the law. I do believe the law is very intrusive. I mean, what business is it of the state government to investigate my employees? I mean, that's my job. They don't need to be licensed. They don't need to be, go through any special training or testing. We are listed as a retail shop. So why do employees of gold dealers need to be investigated? Now, if a company can't, if they hire criminals, well, that's their problem. And I could think of a lot of other businesses that probably hire the same type of employees without their knowledge. And I should have started this a little bit longer, but I'm running out of time, and I wanted to go over a special. I'll bring this to the program again tomorrow. I will post the information on our website, and perhaps it will be on the newsletter this week. So make sure you go to our website, dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Sign up for it, and all the information on this new Minnesota law for gold dealers, it's old. But a lot of the reasons that the law is in effect is because of the dealings that people have had with Minnesota gold dealers. And it's just not all Minnesota gold dealers. It's gold. Some of these gold dealers across the country. And So we'll talk more about it tomorrow. We have a special today, Mint State 64 $20 gold piece, a Mint State 64 $20 gold piece. It's a St. Gaudens. We do have 90% silver in, 90% quarters. We have $100 face value with this package, 90% silver quarters, $100 face value. That means you would receive 400 coins, and the total price on this package is $2,880. And that does include your shipping costs, a mint state 64, $20 gold piece, and 90% silver, $100 space value, $2,880. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you enjoy the program with Alfred and James Corbett. So, and I'll be talking to you tomorrow.
Everyone is afraid of pain. No one wants pain to rule over their life, and you don't want the negative side effects of aspirin, ibuprofen, or prescription drugs. They can lower immunity and cause dependency. Is there a safe alternative? I'm herbalist Wendy Wilson, and I prefer willow bark and meadow sweet herbs to control pain, fever, aches, and inflammation. God's herbs are good, and you won't be disappointed. Call Apothecary Herbs for pain or extra strength pain relief formula. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International, 704-875-8010 or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here in Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T.com. James is calling us, or we're calling him. He's in Japan right now. And James always offers us interesting insight from perspective located out in the Far East. And he has kind of a global grasp on what's happening in the economy of the world. So, James, pleasure to have you on the program again tonight.
How are you? Pleasure to be here. What's on the table?
Well, I'm wondering, did you pay any attention? I know you're in Japan, and I'm not sure that you're interested in this. Did you pay any attention to the Democrat debate on Tuesday night?
Well, it's not because I'm in Japan. I think people all around the world do have a stake in what happens in the American political scene, but it's because I'm not that interested in elections in general. I didn't pay attention to it. I must admit, I didn't see the debate. I've only seen some of the reaction to it, so I can't comment on it with any great degree of specificity.
Okay. Did you see or hear of anything that struck you as surprising?
Hillary Clinton, nothing that I saw.
Agree,
no.
She won. She won the debate. Bernie Sanders remains in the number two position. O'Malley, probably in the number three position. The other two, they're not going anywhere. That's pretty clear. It was surprising to me. I don't like Hillary Clinton, but I had to admit that she was competent and confident, and she did a good job. Surprised me. Surprised me. She was very effective. I think Bernie Sanders was not as effective as some people would have hoped. He wasn't bad. Didn't shoot himself in the foot, but he comes across as a professor more so than a leader. If you catch my drift, I don't think he's going to inspire enough confidence. He has some other advantages. We'll watch and see, but we'll talk about it. There'll be more debates, and we'll see what else happens with the Republicans, the Democrats, and the perils of the American public. Here's one from the Washington Examiner. The headline is GOP to Obama. See, we told you Iran would cheat. Last weekend, Iran tested a new long-range ballistic missile, prompting some to wonder if it had already broken the newly signed nuclear deal. On Monday, top congressional Republicans criticized the administration's strategy in Iran, saying recent actions prove President Obama made a mistake in securing a nuclear deal with a country that cannot be trusted. Do you think Iran can or cannot be trusted? Do you believe the nuclear arms agreement between the United States and Iran was wise, irrelevant, or contrary to American interests? What do you think is going on?
Well, I think people's perspective on this is directly proportional to their knowledge of the agreement itself. And I haven't gone over it with a fine-tooth comb, but I have, you know, looked at enough angles on this deal to know that there really is. I mean, this is a genuine step forward, even if you believe that Iran was aggressively pursuing a nuclear weapons program. There have been some really huge blocks put in place for such a weapons program to be started under the terms of this deal. So, I mean, everything at this point really does hinge on whether or not Iran, you know, does abide by the terms of the deal, and whether also, of course, correspondingly, the U.S. and others abide by the terms by lifting sanctions. And I think there's a great degree of political interest in seeing this deal scuttled or undermined before it ever gets off the ground, which is why I'm taking all of these stories. And there have been a few stories now of, oh, look at this, Iran, you know, isn't going to live up to their agreement. There's been a few of those stories that have kicked around now in the last couple of months. And everyone that I've looked at has been completely based on a pile of sand. It slips through your fingers when you try to lift it up. There was a brouhaha a couple of months ago by a gentleman whose name is going to escape my memory, but he parades himself around as a nuclear weapons expert and a disarmament expert and all of this, although he has absolutely no background in it. He works for a think tank, and it's a common name. You'll recognize it when you hear it. I can't remember. At any rate, he was pumping a story about one of the alleged nuclear sites in Iran that is part under the terms and purview of this deal, where he was saying, look, this satellite imagery shows they've got some trucks there. They're clearly trying to do some cleanup of this site before the inspectors can get there, and which is a ridiculous statement from a number of perspectives. First of all, the satellite pictures that he was warning about literally show trucks at a facility, a military facility in Iran. So how you suddenly go from that to clearly they are doing cleanup operations is one giant leap of the imagination, but also the fact that as people who actually have been inspectors have pointed out, you can't do some sort of emergency cleanup that's going to remove all traces of all of these isotopes. It doesn't matter if you have 20 minutes, 20 hours, 20 days, or 20 years, you're not going to get rid of them all to an inspector that's truly looking for those signs. So a lot of this hype has been hype. I haven't seen this latest accusation, so I can't speak to it, but just from that part that you were quoting from me, it sounds like they're saying, well, this might mean that perhaps Iran is going to proceed with some sort of nuclear program. Again, it's built on a pile of sand, and it just slips through your fingers if you try to pick it up.
Well, we're starting with the premise that Iran was dedicated to creating a nuclear weapon. Is that original premise, was that premise valid to begin with?
Or it was not. Well, even officially so, it was not. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency's official position was that there has never been any proof that Iran diverted any of its nuclear materials to any sort of weapons program in the 12 years or so that the Iranian nuclear program has been under international scrutiny. But they used that in a sort of jujitsu move to take that lack of evidence of any sort that there has been any diversion of any materials to any nuclear program to say, well, yes, but we don't have any proof they didn't divert material to the nuclear weapons program. So, again, the fact that there is no proof whatsoever was somehow used as a point against Iran's favor. But, no, there has never been any basis for this. There's never been any proof whatsoever that there has been any moves towards a nuclear weapons development program here.
Well, it's interesting that if there was never evidence that Iran really had a nuclear weapons program, then while we were negotiating with Iran to make sure they didn't get one, they were negotiating to get, what, $100 billion or whatever back out of the that had been frozen? I mean, from their perspective, they said, what are these people talking about? We never planned on making nuclear bombs in the first place. All we want to do is get our money back. If they want to say, well, all right, fine, we promise we won't celebrate Christmas in Iran, okay, we're not going to celebrate Christmas in Iran. How's that? They're never going to do it anyway. If you catch my drift, they just wanted the money. So the whole thing becomes a little bit strange.
Mm-hmm.
Last point on this is, however, if Iran did test a new long-range ballistic missile that in theory is capable of hitting Israel, what do they need that ballistic missile for? If they're not going to do nuclear weapons, if that's not something they plan to employ, what are you going to put in the warhead of a ballistic missile? I don't think you can just load it up with conventional explosives and have an effect that's cost-effective. The cost of that missile, I think it'd be cheaper to have people strap explosives around their gut and sneak in and detonate the bombs, you know, on the streets of Jerusalem. What are they doing with a new ballistic missile if they're not going to use nuclear weapons?
Well, I think the greater point is an apt one, and perhaps one that should be asked at all of the nations with tactical ballistic missiles in their arsenals. And what are they stocking them for? And why is there, you know, always the presumption that this is needed for national defense? Well, again, like any other nation on Earth, they'll say because we have enemies that have, you know, been threatening us. And by that standard, I mean, clearly, Israel does not like Iran and clearly does see them as a regional rival and a military target. Mm-hmm. And I think the speculation that Israel could even act on its own to try to target Iran's nuclear program if the U.S. fails to be its muscle is not outlandish speculation. That's certainly within the realm of possibility. So from that perspective, you know, the kind of usual national security, we need this to sort of make sure that no one does anything crazy. The idea of having ballistic missiles is not, you know, out of the question crazy. But I would agree on the general point. Well, you know, we should be looking into more general disarmament. We should really be talking about how to dismantle the military-industrial fabric of the entire world. But again, that's a bit pie in the sky at this point.
You know, you talk about the United States being muscle for Israel. I've seen reports, a lot of people claim that the Israelis are controlling the government of the United States, and all right, and they are consistent with what you just implied, that the United States is serving Israel's interests. But I've also seen reports coming out of Israel where people in Israel are swearing up and down that Israel has been captured and is serving the United States' interests. They're concerned that their country is not working for themselves. The question becomes, which tail is wagging which dog? Who's really in control? Is anyone? Does Israel really have undue influence on the United States, or does the United States have undue influence on Israel, or is it pretty much a mutual agreement?
Well, I think it is a good question, but this comes down to why I think it's less useful to think geopolitically in terms of nation states per se. I think there are connected interests in Israel and the United States who have political policy goals that converge at various points. And yes, I mean, I think the sort of Israeli factor in American politics is not even really widely denied at this point. It's just a question of, you know, to what extent that's an insidious influence. But just as one example of that, can you think of any other country that it is almost de rigueur, almost standard, I mean, almost obligatory for any political candidate to assure their fealty to, other than Israel? I mean, it's quite common for congressmen and senators and anyone running for office to come out and say, I'm a staunch, defender of Israel, and, you know, Israel's interests are our interests and things of that nature. That type of rhetoric doesn't even cause anyone to bat an eyelid. But could you imagine if someone came out and said that about Turkey or, you know, any other nation on the planet almost? It would be a sort of strange thing. And I think that's one window into that phenomenon. And, of course, the campaign funds that come from people like Sheldon Adelson that are, you know, I think Trump just made a comment about that. And, you know, that type of thing provides a different type of window on it. And the sort of public, you know, the public pledges and things, the sort of lobbying that people do at AIPAC and the Congress, conferences like that show some of the political influence. But again, I mean, I think you're right to question, is it necessarily Israel that is controlling U.S. foreign policy interests, or is it U.S. that is, you know, using Israel as kind of a puppet in or proxy in that region as the sort of toehold? I think it's a little bit of both ways. And however that works out, it works out in the interests of all the parties. It's not like anyone is being controlled like a robot by some, you know, someone with a remote control. I mean, obviously, these people have their own reasons for supporting this agenda. But it is an agenda that is shared by the power elite in both countries. And it converges on things like demonizing Iran, which is why we get all of this ridiculous, overblown rhetoric about Iran, how Iran is menacing the region, when it's really quite the opposite. Israel is, if anything, much more menacing to Iran than the other way around.
Is it possible that there is a third party? And what I mean by that is this. We have people in Israel that say, oh, the United States is controlling our government. And we have people in this country that say, oh, Israel is controlling our government. Is it really a matter of the Israeli government controlling the government of the United States? Is it a matter of the government of the United States controlling the Israeli government? Or are we looking at something, and you might call them neocons, neo-fascists, who have captured one or both governments? And it's not really the government of Israel and controlling U.S., not really the government of the United States. It's perhaps a more narrow but international faction. Does that make any sense?
Yes. I think there is obviously gradations in Israeli politics, like in American politics, mm-hmm. and you can look at the Likudniks in Israel and the neocons in the United States, and you can start to slice it up that way to see where, you know, I think there's more convergence of policy goals among certain factions and cliques, which mm-hmm. is, again, I think why it's important not to say that this is a nation-state phenomenon so much as a phenomenon that's brought about by connected groups of individuals,
yeah.
sometimes quite powerful individuals that wield a lot of power. And obviously, when their interests converge, things happen. But let's throw some other monkey wrenches into this works, because the Israel-American alliance is often talked about, but there are other wild card factors in the region that play a role, I think a greater role than a lot of people think about. And one that probably not a lot of Americans think about is Turkey and its role in the region and the types of things that it's been up to for decades and decades and decades now. Turkey is a fascinating example of kind of convergence of that secularization trend and trying to turn towards Europe, but still obviously very much an Islamic country and one that has all of its own problems with quote-unquote problems with its own population, including, of course, the Kurdish faction. And it has its own war on terror that it also is covertly supporting. I think Turkey is a really important player in that region that gets overlooked when you start thinking about some of the main power blocks there. But it's one of those things that, you know, I think has a much greater influence. And in the same way, if you look at AIPAC or things like that, you see some of the Israeli influence in American politics. But look at things like the American-Turkish Council. Some very powerful figures sit on the board of that that don't get nearly as much scrutiny as the Israeli angle.
Mm-hmm. It's sometimes you wonder, are we looking at something real in terms of allegations that Israel exercises undue influence on the United States, or United States exercises undue influence on Israel? Is that real, or is that a useful story that some people find it helpful to advance that story, and they can move their own agenda while we are debating, you know, which dog is, or which tail is wagging which dog?
It's, again, a good question, and to my mind, it goes back to that same idea that we tend to conflate countries with the governments, and we tend to conflate governments with the people, and when you do that, it's easy to say Israel controls America, or America controls Israel, or things of that nature, where there may be some version of truth to that, but yes, exactly. It's not monolithic. It's not that type of relationship. And of course, there are Israelis who hate what the Israeli government is doing, in the same way there are Americans who hate what the American government is doing in their name. And I think it's more important to keep those gradations in our thinking so that we can actually form alliances with people who think the same way, even in countries that are supposedly, you know, controlling us or whatever. There are people within that, individuals that can be allied with.
All right, let's take a break for a couple of commercials, and I'll be back with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
A heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
I'm Alfred Adisk, and our guest tonight is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James is calling in from Japan, and we're talking about various financial and political issues from around the globe. For example, here's an article by Michael Snyder, who writes the economiccollapse.com blog. Michael's, you know, a fine writer and prolific. He cranks out a lot of information. He's got an article here entitled Global Financial Meltdown Coming. clear signs that the great derivatives crisis has now begun? I mean, all by itself, that headline is interesting. Clear signs? Do we really have clear signs that the derivative crisis has now begun? And according to Michael, he says, Warren Buffett once referred to derivatives as the financial weapons of mass destruction, and it was inevitable that they would begin to wreak havoc on our financial system at some point. Now, I've heard dire predictions that derivatives problem would destroy the entire global financial system for probably a decade. I've been listening to reports that, oh my gosh, I mean, it was like when they first started talking about derivatives, no one even understood what they were. But they were going to get us. It was the boogeyman. Is there really a derivatives boogeyman out there? And if so, you know, Michael is running around here like a prophet with one of those sandwich boards on him saying that the sign is the end is near. Do you think the end is really near, and are derivatives going to be the trigger?
Well, that's a pretty big question. Is the end near? The end, the timing on the end, again,
not,
is something I can't get
end,
into.
But not the end, but one end.
Right, yes. Well, let's put it this way. The system, as it functions, clearly is fundamentally deficient. We'll put it that way. That's clearly this system is unstable and is prone to collapse. The timing on that is another question, but certainly what we have right now is just a crazy system that is constantly teetering on the edge of collapse. And derivatives themselves are, yes, a very dangerous thing, given that banks now hold, you know, billions upon billions of dollars of various forms of financial instruments on their books that are increasingly difficult to understand. And certain forms of derivatives, I mean, derivatives might be a scary word, but some of them are quite basic and have been used for over a century now. When you look at futures trading, I mean, shorts and going short or going long, puts and calls, these types of things, I mean, at least are pretty easy to understand and wrap your head around. But when you get into some of these, you know, collateralized debt obligations and other things that started the collapse in the last decade, yes, you start to get into things where no one even necessarily knows how much of this exists and how much various people are on the line if something happens, because then you have, of course, credit default swaps as a type of insurance against that. But then what if the other counterparty to the credit default swap goes belly up and you run into a Lehman, or not a Lehman crisis, an AIG crisis or things of that nature? I mean, it starts to become quite mind-bending, and I think no one has a true, total grasp on this phenomenon or this problem. I think we know that there is serious structural problems out there, and as I say, I mean, this system is, I think, inevitably going to collapse back in on itself at some point. But having said that, I mean, these types of headlines, you know, the derivative crisis has begun, has certainly been kicked around for years now, and I think the real risk to this is not in pointing out the fundamental problems or pointing out things, as this article does, about some of that treasury collateral being injected into the repo market, which is a significant move. But I think it's always framing it as in, this is it, you know, now it's happening. It's the boy who cried wolf. I mean, you write that headline once, it might have some relevance. If you write it a thousandth time, I think people are just going to start rolling their eyes. So that's the part of this that I'm uncomfortable with. The analysis, I think, is right on. It's just a question of, you know, does this mean that the collapse is happening as we speak and, you know, any day now?
When we talk about the derivative, some people, I think most people agree there's somewhere in the neighborhood of at least $1 quadrillion worth of derivatives globally. It might be that there's only 800 trillion, but most people probably agree there's $1 quadrillion, and a few people think there might be $2 quadrillion worth of derivatives. Now, you've got to look at this and wonder, how is this even possible? How did anyone come up with an extra $1 quadrillion or $2 quadrillion? I mean, does this make any more sense than the tulip phenomena that struck Holland back, I don't know, late 1800s. I'm not sure when the tulip phenomena hit, but everyone was investing in tulips. Was this just, mm-hmm. is this just craziness? How can we have over $250 billion worth of derivatives? There's an element of irrationality. It's like, oh my gosh, we're being attacked by the balloon people.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I see what you're saying, and I think it's an apt analogy to go back to the tulip bubble, because this is just another form of bubble, and we've seen them come and go many, many times over the centuries, and they always tend to end in the same way. The bubble explodes at a certain point, and I think you're right. This is just another form of that. It becomes more kind of financial wizardry and kind of, you know, impressive sounding with all of these, you know, technical jargon, but the mm-hmm. principle is the same, that there's nothing fundamentally underlying it. And I think it's just an extension of the sort of fundamental lie of our monetary system, the fractional reserve banking system, whereby, yeah, okay, I mean, a bank might have, you know, $10 in deposits, but they can lend $100 out. How does that work? Again, of course, it doesn't work. It's just the bank is just creating money, really, by lending it into existence. And I think it's just an extension from there, from that first abstraction of, well, we have this much underlying it, but no one's actually going to be using that all at the same time, so we can actually lend this much out. It's just a few levels of abstraction to get into these bizarre and, you know, financial instruments and credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities and all of this kind of, you know, shenanigans.
What are the chances that we could have some sort of a collapse in the derivatives markets? And the world just said, so what? It's all imaginary anyway. Doesn't really count. I mean, there's not really $250 billion out there to back this stuff. How real is the threat of the derivatives, you know, collapse? Is it like a story in Star Wars where the Darth Vader's coming to get us?
Hmm.
You know, is it,
well,
because it's so imaginary and irrational,
yeah,
to begin with, is it real?
Well, let's put it in perspective. Yeah, let's put it in the perspective of an actual real-world event, because I think with the Lehman collapse in 2008, we did genuinely see a moment on the brink of a complete shutdown of the financial system as it exists, where you had the possibility of, for example, an AIG that was on the hook for being obligated to all of these other sides of these derivatives that were starting to unwind, and AIG didn't have the ability to back it up. They didn't have the funds to be able to continue those transactions. And you really did risk, well, if AIG goes under, then that's going to bring a whole bunch of other people down, and if they go down, then all... I mean, I think there is that kind of real systemic threat that's posed by these, you know, paper promises, essentially, which is what derivatives are. I mean, these kinds of bizarre, you know, financial instruments that have real-world implications on the functioning of the financial system as it exists. And so I think it's one thing to say, oh, well, you know, what does it matter? Who cares? You know, I don't care about these big banks or financial institutions. But our entire economic reality is woven, the tapestry of that reality is woven with the threads of these financial institutions, so that I think we all understand we do need to transition to a different system, but that transition can be awfully painful. In fact, you know, in a key sense, genocidal, if it's done in a way where basically the fabric of our economic system as it exists just suddenly stops working overnight. If the works start to seize up overnight, that's going to put a lot of people under the wheels of that machine that's going to roll right over them. So I think there is a real world risk of the sort of sudden seizure of the system. If that were to happen, I think that would be, you know, tragic for the average person, not just for these big fat cats on Wall Street, but for the average person who unfortunately has been enmeshed in the gears of this system so fundamentally that I think the process of building up that alternative structure that hopefully isn't prone to these types of disasters is an extremely slow and laborious and intricate one, because, again, every aspect and facet of our lives is backed up and underpinned and undergirded and supported by these various financial institutions, which are, at any moment, really on the brink of that precipice. All it takes is a Lehman going down or something of that sort to precipitate all of these different effects in the real-world economy.
Our entire monetary system, insofar as it's debt-based, is, to me, illusory. The whole thing is an illusion. There's, from my perspective, and yet we're trapped in it because everybody believes in the illusion. So when you talk about an alternative system being created, how can we have an alternative system until we have destroyed the current illusion? I don't think people are going to, we can't sit down and just talk to people and say, well, this is irrational, so we won't believe in that anymore. And they're going to say, wait a second, this isn't irrational. I can take that $100 bill and go to town. Yeah, it's a worthless piece of paper, but it still spends. Can we get them to give up the illusion of the existing system, if you agree it is illusory, can we get them to give that up in a way that's just based on reason and rationality, or is it absolutely necessary that the existing system collapse and people be traumatized, and then they'll say, all right, we got to do something else? Is there a peaceful way to resolve this problem?
Well, I think there is, and this comes down to a question of strategy, and ultimately, how do you convince people to start constructing an alternative system? The actual thing I think that we have to point out to people is that that system already exists to some extent, and almost everybody on the planet is a part of it to some extent, even if they've only got their tiny little toe in it. What I mean by this is the concept of agorism, also known as counter-economics. It was a libertarian philosophy developed by Samuel Edward Konkin III, who started the practice of agorism in 1975 and wrote a book on the subject in 1980, the New Libertarian Manifesto, where he talked, basically he argued that the way to defeat and dismantle all of the political tyranny and all of these sort of secondary effects we see from the economic system that we're living under is not to get into a libertarian party and become elected and start changing things that way. It's to actually act within the economy in the way that we want to see, i.e. without these types of statist controls of various sorts. And his argument was that everyone already does this to some extent in the agora, in counter-economics. And this can be everything as basic as, being paid under the table for some work that people do, all the way up to, outright black market activity, dealing in contraband weapons or drugs or that sort of thing. But everything else besides, everything that is not explicitly part of the sort of economic system, the officially sanctioned economic system. And it could be something like trading with other people in precious metals instead of in fiat dollars or something of that sort. Things that are not part of that system. And as I say, almost everyone participates in some way, in some aspect of their life, in this counter economy already. It's just a question of building up that counter economy and showing people that it is as effective and ultimately more rewarding than the economy that's built that has been built around us. So I think if we're looking at strategy, then it's a question of I think just revealing that this already exists and it's just a question of building it up. Can that reasonably be done? Well, Konkin wrote New Libertarian Manifesto 35 years ago, and most people probably haven't even heard of it. So perhaps it's not been effective yet, but I still think there's hope to it. And in fact, I am putting together a podcast that I hope to release tomorrow on the subject of agorism. So if people are interested, they can find out more about that.
And go to your blog at thecorbettreport.com.
That's right.
All right. I'll have to do it myself because I had never even heard of the term agorism before, 5 minutes ago. That's something I'm familiar with, hadn't heard about it, so I'll be looking forward to the podcast and see what we can learn. We've got about 45 seconds left, James. Is there anything people should be looking for and watching closely over the course of the next week or two?
Well, I think the text of the TPP is supposed to be released in the next week or two. We'll have to keep our eye on that. And when it comes out, I think we'll have a better idea of what's actually in that deal and just to what extent it's going to completely decimate the American economy. So people can look forward to that.
So we get more NAFTA. We're going to get another agreement in the name of global free trade. We will become increasingly impoverished. At least that's the way it looks to me. We're out of time, James. I want to thank you again for being on the program. Always a pleasure, always interesting. I certainly enjoy it. I hope the audience does too. I want to thank all you folks for listening. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a thing.